Next, United States versus Bowling. Mr. Greenlee.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. My name is Andrew Greenlee, and I'm here on behalf of James Bowling. Your Honor's counsel for the government in the case below strenuously argued that he should be allowed to try the case his way, and that the district court shouldn't prevent him from adducing evidence or watering down his case. The fundamental question before this court now is whether the district court failed to afford Mr. Bowling the same deference and thereby deprived him of fairly defending against the charged offenses. With respect to Mr. Bowling's mistake of fact defense, counsel for Mr. Bowling first sought to question the prosecutor regarding whether or not during the disputed time frame Mr. Bowling had been offered a plea agreement that would negate his felony conviction or his felony charges and drop it down to a misdemeanor. The district court prevented counsel for Mr. Bowling from doing so. Mr. Bowling then, later, in an offer of proof, explained to the district court that this goes to his mistake of fact defense. Mr. Bowling's whole position was that, look, I had a plea offer at the time. I understood that this felony charge was going to be dropped down to a misdemeanor, and therefore I mistakenly filled out the form and on form 4473 put that I wasn't under a felony information at the time. Was this an ironclad defense? No. Was he entitled to a judgment of acquittal on this defense? Probably not. Was he entitled to bring this defense before the jury? There's no question that he should have been allowed to do so. Now, in response to opposing counsel's argument that this was not a definitive ruling, I would submit that the ruling couldn't have been more definitive than the district court in this case. It said, I will not let the jury consider whether this preliminary plea offer can be submitted in connection with the claim that a reasonable person would believe that he was not under a felony information. That's a definitive ruling. Once the plea offer was deemed inadmissible, Mr. Bowling couldn't present his mistake of fact defense because the whole premise and factual predicate of the defense was the fact that he had, in fact, been given by the prosecutor this plea offer. So the district court deprived him of his ability to raise a mistake of fact defense. Now, with respect to the materiality, the district court also deprived him of the ability to raise materiality as a defense to the charged crime with respect to Mr. Bowling putting a false address on the 4473 form.
Was that the same address as was on his driver's license?
It was the same address that was on his driver's license. It was the same address that he received his credit card statement. It was within, the testimony differed on this point, but it was within 2 to 3 blocks of the very same house where he lived.
Well, what was at that address at the time?
He ran a business out of that address. He stored property at that address. He still owned that address. The expert witness for the government testified that the reason why you put the correct address, the current residence, on the 4473 form is so they can track you down. He was within 2 blocks from that residence. It was a valid driver's license that he put that current residence at. So our position is that this was a disputed point of fact.
Did he get mail there?
He did receive mail there. That's where he received his credit card bills, is that address. So this was a point of fact that was hotly disputed below, and I'll defer to the government's own brief. They cite extensively to, this is around, I think, page 41 through 44 of the government's brief, they cite extensively to the closing argument of counsel for Mr. Bowling, where he essentially argued, look, Mr. Bowling, this isn't a situation where Mr. Bowling, where they couldn't have found Mr. Bowling, this is not material. that the government itself argues that he presented that argument to the jury. The question is, did the court take that argument off the table by instructing the jury, as a matter of law, that putting the false street address on a 4473 form is material? Now, we know from Gowden and we know from Nieder that materiality is an element. It's an element in the fraud cases. It's an element in cases arising under 18 U.S.C. 1001. And materiality here is squarely within the language of the statute, which calls for the statement, it has to be material as to the lawfulness of the sale. Again, Mr. Bowling's position at trial was that they could have tracked him down. The firearm dealer, who after all had an incentive in consummating the transaction because Mr. Bowling was going to give him money, so this was a live issue, a disputed issue of fact, and the Supreme Court has said that materiality is a mixed question of law and fact, and that it always should be presented to the jury. And our position is that it's reversible error to fail to do so here.
What was the what defense was left then? What was his defense? How was it argued?
Well, mainly it was materiality, although he argued that he didn't have the intent to deceive the firearm dealer, that he just basically put the wrong address down because he didn't read the form closely. But it was bound up with the materiality, that it didn't really matter anyways because Mr. Bowling could be traced here, and the firearm dealer, they wanted to consummate the deal anyways. It's worth noting also that materiality, it also extends to the other charged offense, whether or not he knew that he was under a felony information at the time, because the arresting officer was right there in the store, right? So if the firearm dealer knew that the arresting officer was in the store and had a conversation with the arresting officer, and they did the deal anyways, then it's not likely to or intended to deceive the decision maker with respect to that decision. So materiality extends to both of the two charged offenses. And finally, we also believe that it was sandwiched between those two errors is the old chief error. Counsel for Mr. Bowling sought to stipulate to everything that the government asked in the initial hearing. He said, I will stipulate to the fact that I knew at the time of this pretrial hearing that I was under a felony information. The government spurned the stipulation. And we know from Old Chief itself that where there's an offer of equivalent proof, then the question is not whether the government should be compelled to accept the stipulation. That's independently admissible under Rule 801. So the question then becomes, in a 403 analysis, is the evidence so prejudicial that it outweighs the probative value? And in this case, there's no question that it was. He strangled a 16-year-old after giving a 16-year-old alcohol. That was what was alleged. Can you imagine something more prejudicial than that? Your Honors, I see I'm running low on time. I'll reserve the remainder. Thank you.
Right. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Green. Mr. Rinka?
Please, the court, counsel, good morning. Matthew Rinka on behalf of the United States. First and foremost, I would just say that I think that the government has covered these issues extensively in its brief, but I would highlight a few issues, expand upon them perhaps. The first issue with respect to the allegation that Mr. Bowling was denied the ability to present a defense, in the government's view, context of this is important. Prior to the trial in this case, the defendant sought to introduce the ultimate plea agreement and final disposition of his case in the state court that was rendered in October of 2012. So, if several months after the allegations charged in the federal indictment. By ruling of the district court, he was not allowed to present that evidence. The theory that the defense put forward, under which they thought this evidence was admissible, was they thought the jury should have an opportunity to examine the ultimate disposition they thought it was relevant. The district court held it was not and said the issue before this jury is what was the status of the charging document at the time that Mr. Bowling purchased these firearms. What happened after that was not relevant, and there is a plethora of case law on that point. That was a correct ruling by the district court. So we fast forward to trial. And the cross-examination...
So this is a matter of timing. In other words, when the form was signed, there had been no disposition. Nothing had happened to that original charge?
No, at the time he purchased the firearms, nothing had happened to that original charge. Those original charges were still pending. And the elected county prosecutor who was in charge of that case appeared at trial and testified that all of those charges were still pending at the time that Mr. Bowling purchased that firearm. Now, we fast forward to the trial, and on cross-examination of that elected county prosecutor, counsel for the defendant, Mr. Bowling, attempted to elicit testimony only, that Mr. Bowling had been offered a plea agreement by the state, and that plea agreement was to plead to a misdemeanor. Initially, as we can read in the transcript, the district court thought that counsel was wantonly trying to subvert the court's prior ruling. But defense counsel then took another tack and said, well, Judge, what we're really arguing is that the presentation of this plea offer to Mr. Bowling in July, as documented by a letter from Mr. Bowling's attorney, caused Mr. Bowling to have a, quote, mistake of fact, unquote, with respect to what the status of his charges is. He was essentially saying by that letter he thought, mysteriously, the county had dropped the felony charge against him. Mind you, it was a two-sentence letter that said, this is a preliminary. Preliminary was bolded and underlined in the actual letter. Preliminary offer to resolve your case. Please call me when you've had a chance to review it. And the district court said, well, at that time, the district court thought that counsel was trying to introduce that document. And counsel said, well, no, I don't think that Mr. Cavanis, the county prosecutor, can lay a foundation for it. I'm just using it to refresh his recollection as to the time frame. And repeatedly told the district court, all we're trying to do is get Mr. Cavanis to testify that he made an offer. That was the extent of it. That was all the district court ruled on. At that point, we can see from the transcript that the district court was concerned that basically defense counsel was going to leave this issue hanging. They weren't going to link it up. In other words, they were going to ask Mr. Cavanis that question, was this plea offer made? And then they were not going to link that up in their case and present any evidence whatsoever that Mr. Bowling actually had a mistake of fact.
What would they then? What were they afraid of? That he would show that he was not mistaken. I'm trying. The reason is because when you patch those three things together,
yes, Your Honor,
it does kind of bothers me at least to think that whatever he could do, he could look at it one way because the checking that box is extremely important to gun owners. And that's why that is what the people who are pro-gun, so to speak, really say, look, that is the whole key. And that's very important that be used because that keeps the bad guys from getting guns.
Yes, Your Honor.
And I assume there's some motive in that. But I leading up to that, it just seems that this... it's sort of a far-fetched defense, if you call that the mistake of back defense, if he thought he was off the hook, and that would be argue, and then I suppose it got very deep in it, they'd show that he knew he wasn't off the hook.
Except, Your Honor, that what the district court was saying was that you were kind of putting the cart before the horse.
Yeah.
You're asking us to elicit this testimony from this particular witness, but there's nothing in here that suggests, there's no credible evidence whatsoever to suggest that he actually had a mistake of fact. And what the district court was obviously concerned with was the fact that with this evidence in the record, counsel's intent was then to argue, well, that was sufficient to trigger a mistake of fact, but there was no evidence of that.
Which wouldn't get very far, probably.
And so we have, yes, Your Honor, and so it at that point it wouldn't have been relevant because it did not make any fact at issue more or less probable. Now
the actual fact was the charge was still a felony when he signed the, when he checked the box.
If the charge was still pending, in the government's view, it wouldn't have mattered. But with respect to the ability to present a defense, I think the issue becomes one of, well, if the defense had tactically decided to use their defense case to put on evidence, and they could have done it in a number of ways, up to and including should Mr. Bowling have decided tactically that he wanted to testify, he could have testified, I received this letter, this is how I perceived it. They could have recalled Mr. Cavaniss to say, yes, this offer was made, to bolster Mr. Bowling's testimony. The problem is that Mr. Bowling decided tactically not to take the stand and not to testify.
Which he was that never pleading guilty or something?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Was the court looking at that as he may be pleading guilty if he testified?
No, Your Honor. No, I don't think so, Your Honor. If his testimony was what they suggest in their appellate brief, maybe the jury would have bought off on it. No one knows. But the fact is, it is difficult for us to assess that now because the testimony was not subject to direct examination, so we don't know what he would have said, nor was it subject to cross-examination. And I would highlight for the court, there were a lot of good tactical reasons for him not to take the stand, including the fact that the letter from counsel to Bowling transmitting his preliminary offer was dated the 18th of July, 4 days after he signed that 4473. It was postmarked Indianapolis, 19 July, 5 days after he signed that 4473, and the day he actually picked up the firearm. It was postmarked in Indianapolis.
That's my question. The fact was, at the time he signed it, there is nothing. It was still a felony, no offer, no nothing.
Absolutely, Your Honor. At the time he signed that document, the 4473, the felony charge was still pending.
And no offer had been made yet to him.
As far as we know.
That he knew about.
Exactly. As far as we know, Your Honor, the answer is no. Because the only thing that we have in the record is that letter, which was dated 4 days after he initially signed that 4473. And so we fall back on the other thing, which is, if his mistake of fact was to be believed, it had to have been reasonable. And the district court also picked up on the fact that it probably was not reasonable for somebody to read that letter 4 days after he signed the 4473 and believe that his case had just mysteriously gone away.
Would that have changed his mind? I'm trying to look at it from his point of view. It's maybe 4 days earlier, if he'd known that, he wouldn't have signed it. He wouldn't have checked the box. I don't know.
It's possible, Your Honor, but again, we don't know because he didn't take the stand. And I just want to highlight, not only do we have the issue with the dates on the form, but we also have the subsequent issue, which is clear in the record and certainly clear from the testimony at sentencing, that 2 days before the trial in this, or excuse me, 2 weeks before the trial in this case, Mr. Bowling went to the post office in Manila, Indiana, changed his home of record address from 9405 West Pearl Street to the address on West 250 South, and asked the postmaster in Manila, Indiana, to backdate that form for him, which she testified at sentencing would have been a violation of postal regulations. But that backdating the form by 1 year from late August 2013 to late August of 2012 would have been essentially manufacturing evidence in this case. And that's essentially what Judge McKinney found at sentencing as well. Your Honor, just very briefly, I would submit to the court that with respect to the issue of the materiality, we outline this extensively in our brief, but number one, we believe that the materiality in this case is used in this statute significantly differently than it is in the 1001 type statutes that are cited by the appellant. I would submit to the court that here we are talking about materiality with respect to the lawfulness of this transaction, which is a question of law. And even if it was error to give that instruction, I would submit to the court that in this particular case, as it was in the Dickerson case cited by the government, the underlying predicate facts are so closely related to the ultimate question. In other words, based on the testimony of trial in this case, no reasonable jury could have concluded that he put a false residence address on that form without also concluding, based on the testimony of trial, that that was material to the lawfulness of the sale. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Ringo. Mr. Greenlee.
Your Honor, just so we're clear here, Mr. Bowling's defense was that he had received information about this plea offer. And that was exactly what they were attempting to elicit from Mr. Cavanis. I'm going to read from the transcript here, page 75. Counsel for Mr. Bowling said, "What I am offering to introduce is his statement, Mr. Cavanis' statement. Yes, during this period of time, an offer to dismiss the felony had been communicated. The court, all right, the ruling is you can't." And the court explained its ruling previously, "I'm not going to let a jury look at that and speculate as to whether that could cause a person to reasonably conclude that there was no indictment at the time." So, look, that defeats the government's entire argument on this point. The court told Mr. Bowling, "You can't raise that argument." So why would he testify? The court is like, defense counsel can't be forced to be held in contempt of court to preserve an argument for appellate review. That's a definitive ruling. The court said, "You can't raise that mistake of fact defense. Our argument is that is error as a matter of law." And again, Judge Candy, to address your point, his whole position was, "I did receive this plea offer from the government," from the state prosecutor.
If it had gone forward from the state prosecutor, you could only elicit that he sent it, right?
Well, no, the letter wasn't sent from the prosecutor. The letter wasn't sent from the prosecutor to Mr. Bowling.
No, I understand.
Okay.
So who did the letter go to?
Well, the letter went from counsel for Mr. Bowling to Mr. Bowling. Now, we all know how plea offers work. You pick up the phone, the prosecutor has a conversation with defense counsel. "What do you think? Let's drop this down." Okay. Now, what's to prevent counsel for Mr. Bowling to relay that offer and say, "Hey, look, there's an offer on the table
here"? How was that, as part of the defense, how was that to be established?
Well, Mr. Bowling himself, had the court allowed it, he could have testified, "Yes, my attorney would have told me that." And in fact,
was that representation made to the district judge, that that's what would follow on if permitted?
Yeah, in fact, in the pretrial hearing, counsel for Mr. Bowling said, we think that we might call Mr. Barada, his attorney, to get his testimony as to whether or not he communicated this offer with Mr. Bowling in the relevant time frame. That happened. The district court knew full well exactly what Mr. Bowling was trying to do, and it said, "No, you can't do that." Briefly, with respect to the relevance, look, the ultimate disposition was relevant to mitigate, to take the sting out of these incredibly prejudicial allegations, which at this point were only allegations, right? So he should be able to counteract that with evidence that, in fact, the whole thing was trumped up and it was dropped down to a disturbing the peace charge. You know, the state prosecutors are not in the business of allowing someone who strangles a minor to just walk free on that type of charge, right? So the case had warts, and it was overcharged in the first place. Now, with respect to the suggestion that there was no foundation, the letter itself is the foundation. And the reason why there was no foundation for the defense is because the court wouldn't allow Mr. Bowling to even question the prosecutor on this very point. And that is, Your Honor, is the reason why this court should reverse.
Mr. Greenlee, did you have a relative that worked in this court?
Yeah, Your Honor, I believe my brother
was clerk for me, right?
Yeah, yeah. I would ask that you don't hold that against me or my client. Your Honors, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Greenlee. Thank you, Mr. Rinkler. Case taken under advisement. Court will stand in recess.